Hello everyone, welcome to yet another episode of the Smashy Business Show. Today is Tuesday, 29th of October, it's 10 a.m. in the UAE, and we are going to talk about a lot of business stories and big numbers, billions and millions, not small numbers. It's the season of business, to be honest. Whenever winter is starting, whenever the outdoor weather is getting better, everything starts happening in this region.
Everything's getting better.
I have been Worth, the charismatic Word. How are you, Worth? How is your day going?
I'm good. My day's going good. I started out with some good music. What about you?
I started off by dropping my son and then coming here. So it's a good day to talk about business. First of all, let's talk about the biggest thing that is kicking off today. The pre-summit event started yesterday, but FII, that is Future Investment Initiative Conference, the 8th edition is kicking off in Riyadh. Yesterday on Monday, they had a pre-summit event about Africa, the new Africa, the up-and-coming Africa. The focus was on youth, minerals, semiconductors, everything, electricity, sustainability. The focus was on Africa. So Riyadh's Future Investment Initiative Conference, it's also called the Davos in the Desert. Because there's a very big conference that happens in Davos, so they're like now calling it Davos in the Desert. I was reading Richard Attias, who is the CEO of FII Institute, basically, which holds this conference. And he said that he didn't like the name in the start, Davos in the Desert, but now he's fine with it because it's like everyone calls it that.
So
that's happening. It's expected to host 8,000 participants from around the world, and we'll talk about how those 8,000 participants come in. It's not free. And the summit will focus on technology, finance, and sustainable development. These are the main themes. There's like a chance of $30 billion of deals being signed at the event in Riyadh. So this is one of the biggest news coming out of it. Again, announced by Richard Attias, the CEO. For the interviews that he was doing before the event started, the marketing press conferences basically. And the event has already drawn over $120 billion in cumulative investments since its inception. Over the last seven editions, $120 billion worth of deals have been signed in FII. Our CEO, Richard, is there. So we'll be reporting from the location some background, whatever is happening on our stories. So do follow us on social media. And obviously, we'll be talking a lot about it in our newsletters as well. So go subscribe to the newsletter as well.
And you know how you said it's not free?
Yeah.
The membership model for FII actually requires a $15,000 annual fee for access. I mean, I think it's worth it.
Yeah, everyone thinks it's worth it.
I believe it's worth it for the networking.
The biggest people that you can think of from the Wall Street, from the business world, the global business world, not even in the Middle East, the global business world, they're there. So you always have an opportunity to catch up with someone. You have an opportunity to network with the biggest people who hold billions of dollars under their management, like assets under management, under the companies, BlackRock, one of the biggest names, the CEO is going to be there. So yeah, these guys are paying $15,000. And it's not just FII in Riyadh that is happening. There's a lot of other events. And FII has a very big content bank. That was what was surprising for me, that when you become a member, you get access to a lot of reports, a lot of numbers, a lot of figures, which are not open to public. So you get access to that. So $15,000 is for that as well. And you get obviously preferential treatment in all of their events. So yeah, this is happening. Let's talk about something that happened on Monday. The New Africa Summit happened, which is a precursor to the main event, which is starting today, the FII conference. And it brought business leaders and political leaders to discuss Africa's infrastructure, energy, and youth potential. Africa's median age, it was reported, is 19. Very young population.
Extremely young.
It positions it as an emerging investment hub with unique opportunities that align well with FII's objective. One of the youngest populations globally, Africa's growing workforce, seen as a challenge and an opportunity. Obviously, with so many young people, you need so many jobs. And you need to create a career for them in different industries.
But do you think people should start working from that young of an age?
I think yes.
I agree with you too.
Yeah. You should have some idea of what you want to do by the time you're 16 or 17. Of what you want to
do.
Not start
expectation.
Working. Not start working, but at least have an idea of what you want to do. And with, to be honest, with social media and with everything on your fingertips, all the knowledge, access that you have, I believe the best idea is to learn everything and anything possible within, like, you should have a plan for a year that this year, this 4-6 months, I'm learning about this, this concept, this idea. Because university, if you go, what I've seen with universities, you go and you specialize in a subject. But now, I guess the world has moved on from specializations. Yeah. You need to be a specialist in one subject matter, but you need to be a jack of all trades as well. So it's complicated now. It's not that simple. For example, very simple example, a doctor. Now, they're giving them communication lessons. They're adding communication courses to the whatever medicine and surgery and everything related to medicine that they learn. They're teaching communication as well because they have to communicate with their patients.
Yeah.
So it's like one specialization, jack of all trades.
But
so
a jack of all trades is usually a master of none, though.
Yeah. So again, there's a mix now. Sure, the world has moved on from either this or this. It's like a combination of both things now.
I know it's moved on, but usually from what I've noticed is that when someone is usually good at something, they should just go with that. That's truly what I believe.
As a career path, I think it's perfect, but adding more skills to your CV and your personal like personality.
Yeah.
For example, if I only studied business throughout my life and I'm only good with numbers, I would never be able to sit here and talk. So I had to add that communication skill set in me as a person, as a personality, in my CV. So yeah, if you want to like become the best in the world, if you want to achieve some form of excellency in whatever you're doing, you need to keep adding new skills. And with AI coming, data analytics coming, data visualization is a field, I think you can't rely on one thing. What if it becomes obsolete after 5 years? Technology is crazy.
Okay, that's true. Yeah. That's true. Maybe with technology, that's very true. But I think if you're good at one thing and you do it well, you can be extremely successful.
Yeah, but keep adding new skills. Keep adding new skills. There's this video live right now at 10 on Instagram. There's the NVIDIA CEO, Jensen Huang. Bollywood actor Akshay Kumar, I don't know if you guys know him, but he's a big actor. He's like one of the top 5 actors in India. He was hosting an event and he asked Jensen Huang a very good question. And I loved that video. That is why we shared it on our socials as well on Smashy Business. He asked him, how will AI replace me? One. And what is that one thing that AI can't do that humans can do? So Jensen Huang's reply was like classic. He said, AI will help you like make 20% of your work do better than you, maybe 30%, maybe 50%. But AI still doesn't have the capability to do everything that you do. It can't replace 100% of you. So he didn't say that AI will replace you. He said people who use AI to automate that 20-30% of their work
will replace you.
Those people will replace you.
Yeah,
so,
I agree
with you.
So
if you're good in finance, if you can find some kind of AI to automate the mechanical processes, you'll be good at your job.
You know,
I
remember I didn't like ChatGPT that much, by the way. I didn't like it that much at first, and I wasn't using it because to me, in my mind, just the knowledge that I did something authentically and it's my work done, that brings me a lot of pride.
My piece of writing, right?
Yeah, and basically. I guess it was because of school. Like, it was drilled into me that, you know, you can't plagiarize.
Yeah.
It's very, it's not authentic in the end of the day. And it's not ethical. That's how I felt. But then I had somebody speak to me and they told me that if you don't use AI in the end of the day, you look like you're slower than all your colleagues. Yeah. You look like the slowest person in the room.
And I guess there's a very important skill when you're working in a very fast-paced environment like UAE, adaptability. A lot of people downplay it, but adaptability is key to your growth. If, 100%. For example, if you're an employee right now or if you're a junior executive, if you're adaptable enough, then you will shift towards a managerial role or a directorial role. If you're not adaptable, you still have that employee state of mind and you'll always be looking for orders or directions.
I see what you mean, but when you say the word adaptable, in what sense?
Adaptable in, again, if there is a new AI tool which can make your job easier, you have to adapt. You have to be like, okay, I'm not going to write 2,000 words by myself, type them out. Maybe use ChatGPT, maybe use, there's like 1 million writing softwares now. You can use them not to write like the whole of it, But to get new ideas, for example, the best thing I do it for is headlines. So yeah. Sometimes, obviously, every human brain has a capability of storing vocabulary to an extent. Mm. ChatGPT or the AIs, they don't have that like limitation. A human brain does. The best of the best people in the world will have a limitation. So ChatGPT helps you with finding new ideas for headlines, for new angles. So it's like a wall that I use to throw ideas and get something back. It's like a conversation with a colleague, but usually colleagues are busy with their work. So yeah, you can use it in those ways, creative ways. Mm. Not the like, just write this 500-word article on this. You can be like, oh, I'm exploring this idea. Explain the angles that I can take. You can look at those angles and then there comes your human connection, the human ingenuity. See, that, I'll take this angle, looks more interesting.
I agree with all of that. Yeah. But I believe that, you know, for climbing the corporate ladder, I don't think it's necessarily just adaptive. I think it's amazing, but I genuinely think it's communication.
Yeah.
You know, your ability to be an easygoing person, to communicate with any kind of personality, not just people you deem nice.
What I've seen is,
I think that's what does
it. It's a very cliche thing that happens in at least my Asian region, Pakistan, India, all that. A lot of people who do engineering, like hardcore engineering, circuits or programming, they don't have communication courses throughout their 4 years of bachelor or 2 years of associate bachelors. What they do is, once they finish their engineering, they understand their circuits and their datas and their languages, they go on and do an MBA. MBA is more about communication, writing skills and all that. So they do it because they don't get that kind of exposure during their bachelors. So a lot of people doing engineering are doing MBAs to understand the communication environment, and then they get placed in good high positions. So they evolve into roles where they have to talk more and do less engineering, but they know their basics. So yeah, it's happening. Like, everyone is trying to get some piece of something from anywhere.
I see what you mean, but I think with, you know, communication skills, I don't think they stem from your education.
Yeah,
I think it stems from the way that you grow up, the way that your family is.
The whole village that raises
you. I do think that, because that's the way that I'm raised. Yeah. You know, it's weird if guests come over and you're just silent. Like, why are you silent?
Yeah, go talk to them. Ask them what they do.
Exactly.
Yeah, take interest in them.
Yeah, that's very unacceptable. Yeah, that's very unacceptable in Sudanese culture. Yeah. How is it like in your culture?
Yeah, you have to go and entertain the guests while your mom and dad or anyone prepares something for them. You have to go entertain the guests, tell them a poem that you've learned. With small kids, it's cuter things. With big kids, you need to have a conversation with them.
Yeah, that's for sure. So, but you know what I'm recently seeing, by the way? The people that I find are the most sociable are the ones raised in their home countries.
Oh, yeah.
Not the ones raised here.
I guess it involves a lot of factors. It's not only being in your home country. It's the comfort of language, I guess, as well. Because if someone moves from Pakistan at the age of 17 or 18 and they come here to the UAE, they have to constantly communicate in English. You can't speak Urdu to a lot of people. You find, obviously, Pakistanis here, you can speak to them in Urdu, but the major mode of communication is English. Mm-hmm. And they're very hesitant. So language also plays a big role. There's like 1 million things that I can think of that play a role in a person from becoming an introvert to becoming an extrovert, maybe in the form in communication terms, like speaking on any topic anywhere with
anyone. Do you usually think it's just a personality thing or confidence?
No, I think it's a learned trait. Confidence, communications, they're all learned traits. You just need to now it's very easy. Go find some guru, a good, well-read, a popular one on YouTube, and see his videos. He'll teach you the basics of your hand communication, your physical communication, your verbal eye contact. They can teach you all the tricks. Or read a very good book on communication from some expert author.
Really? No. I don't think that's going to do
books
anything.
Books go a little deep, but YouTube videos are easier to watch. You can just listen to them.
Experience much more. Experience. Like, get out there, you know?
Theory, then
go
practical.
Play basketball with people. Go walk in the park. Yeah. I feel like people need to get off their phones. I get it. I get it. We all live on social media now. And, you know, we have digital assets. We have all kinds of things on our phones. But to be more human and to be more authentic, you need to get out. You need to experience life more.
I'll give you my example from my family. Me and my brother, like a world poles apart. My brother and me, we grew up in the same environment, same school, nearly the same teachers. My brother, he doesn't talk to strangers on the road. He doesn't even talk to me a lot. I can literally talk to everyone on the road. Any person I meet, if I'm buying tea and I see a person standing right next to me, I'll start talking to them. So I don't know what the X factor is, but because we have the same environment, but we grew up completely different.
But like, if so, he's forced, there is something will he that talk? We're missing. If he's forced, will he talk?
If he's forced, he'll say two sentences, ask, how are you? How's your health? And then he'll stay silent. So, yeah, that's again, same environment.
But
everything
think,
was perfectly
but
same.
I think
we had
there
the
are
same
people
teachers
who are genuinely
nearly.
Like that. They don't enjoy talking that much.
Some of it is inborn, I guess, and some of it you learn over the period. I loved reading, so maybe
same.
That helped me become a better orator. Like, I can speak to people. He didn't. He wasn't good on reading. So yeah,
wait,
coming
what,
back
what is
to
his
the
profession,
topic.
By the way, I'm genuinely curious. What's his profession?
He works in management, like a managing job. He works for a company which provides office sharing spaces. So he doesn't talk to a lot of people as well. I guess my career choice was also more talking to people because I can, maybe.
Yeah.
So yeah, coming back to FII, we diverted to a different discussion, very healthy discussion to be honest. But yeah, FII is kicking off today. Richard Attias is most probably going to open the ceremony. Richard Attias, some thing if you want to know about the guy, how he created the whole FII event. Basically, it was the idea of Mohammed bin Salman, who is the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia. If you want to read the whole interview, it's on AGBI. You can read the whole interview. But the main idea is Mohammed bin Salman, when he like wrote down or created the idea of Saudi Vision 2030, he came to Richard Attias and said that I'm creating this vision. I want people to invest in the Saudi economy. So make something which brings everyone to Riyadh or Saudi Arabia and they talk about investing. So this is where the idea originated from. And eventually, Richard Attias, who also runs his own company, Attias and Associates, he has an own business as well. He created the FII Institute, which is a non-profit institute, just to tell you. So whatever they earn from memberships, Word told you they do $15,000 membership, annual memberships. Apart from that, the strategic investors who invest in FII Institute and all the work that they do, they pay $2 million per year to be associated with the name of FII. Mm. So one of the biggest investors is PIF. So yeah, so Saudi couldn't take the event, but now they're one of the biggest investors in the event. And that is why it takes place in Saudi Arabia.
Speaking of their strategic moves, actually, there is an island opening in Saudi Arabia.
Yeah.
You know. Yeah.
It opened. It opened to a select number of people, but for public, it will open
soon. It's still not open to the entire public, but essentially this island, it has 5-star hotels, it has the Four Seasons, it has a Marriott, it has fine dining restaurants, high-end retail outlets, and a yacht club. And what's really nice about it is that it's in Neom. So it's I believe it's in between Egypt and it's close to Egypt and Jordan.
The gate to Red Sea. So yeah, most probably it will be that part of the region. But this is the first physical location that we've seen opening up in the NEOM project. So NEOM is a very big project. It's divided into 4 big parts, if I'm not wrong. Sindala, Trojan, The Line, and one more. So these 4 parts then grow up into different parts. So Sindala is one of the island locations, and it's a luxury island location. So whatever you go and do there,
$500 billion.
It's just going to be luxury thing. Michelin star chefs, Michelin star restaurants. So if you really, really want to experience luxury, this is the place to be. And yacht, obviously yacht clubs and the golf course that they have there. It's I remember 22 or 18. It's like a full fledged golf course. So you can enjoy all that when it opens for public and you can get registration or hotels. I remember Marriott is one of the first that is opening, and there's another one, completely forgot the name, sorry. But Marriott is one of the 2 big luxury restaurants that are opening there for the start. And then obviously they'll keep adding new restaurants and everything there. So yeah, Sindala is, the good thing is finally, people can see something physically placed in the NEOM project.
Yeah.
Everyone had their doubts about NEOM. They had to do a lot of budget cuts, to be honest. The line from like a kilometer or 100 kilometers, it was brought down to 1 kilometer by 2030. They are going to build the whole of it, but their plan was to build it by 2030, the whole of it, the whole 100 kilometers. Now they've reduced the target to 1 kilometer
by
2030.
You know, I think what makes this really beautiful to me is that You know, we're finally seeing that Saudi Arabia, it's moving from just being a religious place for Muslims, which that in itself, it's very special. Yeah. It's very special to me. But now that, like, you know, if I take a trip and I go to the Hajj, I also know that at the end, like, I can go for, you know, I can go for a touristy tour. I can go to I can go to an island. And I think that's pretty impressive.
And with all these seasons kicking off, I remember when I went, like, 3 months ago, the Jeddah season was on. So under Jeddah season, there's like hundreds of events happening, shopping festival, this match, that football match, this thing, that thing. In every entertainment avenue that you can think of, Jeddah season was hosting people. Now the Riyadh season started like two weeks ago. So Riyadh season, under that, there's sports events, there's entertainment events, there's movie launches. Everything that
people
you can
think of. People
have
activities now. They finally have activities. Yeah. And just so, they have a lot of options.
Prince Mohammed bin Salman's idea of changing the landscape of Saudi Arabia, it's actually taking place. And the biggest project, NEOM, finally we have the first physical location. One of the funny numbers that I was reading on Bloomberg. So, yeah, telling the source is always important. So on Bloomberg, there's a whole report about it, how Saudi Arabia planned all of this. And how they're cutting their budgets down and everything. So the number, interesting number that I found, according to Bloomberg, oil should be at $96 a barrel so that Saudi Arabia can earn enough to complete the NEOM project. Right now, oil is dropping a lot. We did a story on it yesterday. It dropped nearly 5% yesterday. Yesterday or day before yesterday. So in this week. So right now, it's around 80-ish. Dollar, and in the past year it's fluctuated between $68 to $80. But for Saudi Arabia to earn enough through their oil resources, they have a lot of oil to sell to the world, so the oil needs to be at 96 barrel. And then when they sell the oil, they'll get enough money to complete the NEOM projects. I was like, that's a very like detailed, very down to the important number calculation,
very rigorous.
So, yeah, so oil is going down. Also OPEC, the thing with all the oil producing companies, call it a organization where all the oil producing countries sit, they cut down their forecast for the need of oil. So because of that, every country is now producing less oil. So less production, less selling, less money. So Saudi Arabia may face some budget deficits. They will have to rethink where the money for the whole NEOM project will come from. But this event, FII happening, a lot of other events happening, people coming and investing in Saudi Arabia,
and it's
a lot of other things, startups bringing in money. So all this is contributing to moving away from oil, one, and also bringing the important dollars in for the NEOM project. So it's very complicated, but it's a very nice story to understand how these mega giga projects are built. It's not just, oh, Saudi Arabia has the money, they built it. You need to keep earning it year by year, meeting your targets year by year, and then taking that money and investing in the NEOM project.
And speaking of money, Lulu Hypermarket has really brought in the money. Yeah. Essentially, what they did recently is that they released their IPO, and they are selling 2.58 billion dirhams in shares, which is essentially 25% of the company. Now, why is this really interesting? Essentially, what they're doing to the people who are buying these, the 25% of these shares, they are offering them 75% profit in dividends.
Yeah. And the range price was announced between 1.94 dirhams and 2.04.
So people can negotiate. Per share.
Yeah. But the good thing is, as soon as it opened, in the very first hour, all the shares were sold. So it was subscribed, and most probably now it will be oversubscribed as the days go by. 14 November, I guess, is the date when everything will be final, and we will start, everyone who bought the shares will start trading on ADX, the Abu Dhabi Stock Exchange. The idea was that they also wanted to go to Tadawul on the Saudi market as well. They wanted to do a dual listing. So that brings in more money. But then they were like, no, it's very difficult. The Saudi paperwork for listing is more complicated than Abu Dhabi.
I see.
So they were like, sorry, let's do it right now with Abu Dhabi, and in the next year, in the first
quarter. And Abu Dhabi is a perfect location, yeah, isn't it? The richest, it's the richest city in the world right now, I believe.
Richest city for sovereign wealth funds. $1.4 trillion in sovereign wealth funds only. So yeah, richest sovereign wealth fund-based city in the world. They beat Oslo this year. So yeah, Lula is offering 2.5 billion eight shares, representing 25% of the company. I was explaining to Worth, it's really complicated to understand how the people who actually invest will get the dividends. But in very simple words, out of the 100, if the company is represented by a number 100, 75% of the company is still owned by the people who are Lulu investors or the Lulu owners. So they'll get 75% of the share. Out of the remaining 25% of the profit, they will give 75% back in dividends or as profits, easier word, profits, to the people who now invest. Mm. And out of that 25%, the 25% remaining will be used for expansion and obviously making their products
and
better.
And I think it's a good bet, to be honest with you, because yeah. Lulu Hypermarket has over 600,000 shops. Do you shop there?
Yeah, sometimes really? Whenever I shop whichever thing is convenient to me. So if I go to some mall and there's Lulu there, I'll shop from there. If I go to some place, there's Carrefour there, I'll shop
It's
there.
Very convenient for finding certain spices. Yeah.
And they have a lot of locations. That's the good part. It's not just like they have one store in some remote area. They have a store everywhere. And funnily, I noticed this, and maybe some people will agree who have lived in Abu Dhabi and Dubai. Abu Dhabi has more Lulu hypermarkets.
Yeah, I noticed.
Yeah,
I
you
noticed
go
this.
Anywhere in Abu Dhabi, you'll find a Lulu. It's difficult to find a Carrefour. But in Dubai, you'll find Carrefour more, or you'll find Spinneys, or you'll find some other markets. But these are the main players. In Abu Dhabi, everywhere there is a Lulu. Wherever you go. So I found it interesting because, again, it's Abu Dhabi-based. It grew from Abu Dhabi. So maybe they focus more on Abu Dhabi. But it's a really interesting thing that I noticed. If you think this is true and if you've seen this, comment. Tell us.
And I also, the reason why I also love Lulu Hypermarket and it's like, its significance in the region, it's because it's so culturally relevant. Yeah. Like, for example, I have an Indian friend and I was speaking to them and every single time they tell me about their grocery runs, it's at Lulu. And I'm like, you don't go to, like, why don't you go to Carrefour? Because I go to Carrefour. Yeah. And then they actually told me because there are certain spices and ingredients that they only find at Lulu. And that's so amazing because that's like a piece of home for them. And it's accessible for them through Lulu.
Yeah.
And I even noticed something else, by the way. Basically, when I bake, I love using like, you know, high quality dark chocolate. I like to use Lindt. And I bake banana cake, by the way. Best banana cake in the world. I'll make it. But basically, for the dark chocolate, there was just a one-off day where I went to Lulu to get it.
Okay.
And I noticed the dark chocolate, the Lindt dark chocolate, it was way more expensive in Lulu than in Carrefour. And I was confused. I was like, wait. Like, I thought Lulu was cheap. But then what I realized is it's because of the fact that in Lulu Hypermarket, this is not something their customers buy in demand, so they're going to make it more expensive.
It's the basic demand-supply function.
Yeah.
Lulu people buy Kit Kat, maybe, but they won't buy Lindt.
Exactly.
Carrefour people buy Lindt.
Exactly.
And in the Spinneys, the high-end one, they also buy. Spinneys went for IPO this year as well, and they got a lot of money out of it, nearly $1 billion out of their IPO.
Wow.
So Lulu, I guess they're following the script, and they're like, okay, we can do that as well. So Lulu, their main idea for this IPO, the money that they will get, it's nearly around $1.8 billion to $2 billion. They will use it for expansion throughout the region and in the world. So you'll soon see a Lulu hypermarket in UK maybe, in Europe maybe. So yeah, that's the main idea. They're going for expansion. So that is why they're going to the public. Thank you so much for joining us today. We had a very constructive conversation.
For anybody who lost out on investing in Lulu, just so you know, Talabat and Alpha Data are also preparing for IPOs by the end of the year.
Yeah.
So if you lost out, you can still invest.
Yeah. Always there is something going for an IPO, a big brand. So yeah, Delivery Hero owned, which is a German company, Talabat is going for an IPO this year. They're trying for this quarter. Let's see if it is successful. Thank you very much for joining us today. If you're one out of the 1.3 million listeners that we have, thank you very much for you're not just a number. We respect you for listening to us every day, and we would want you to keep listening to us.
Yeah.
Follow us on all social.
Follow
us on all social media. And this is the Smashy Business Show. We're going over time, so just trying to wrap up quickly. We have a newsletter. Go follow it. We have we're on all social channels, and we're all audio platforms. Just find write Smashy Business whenever you open your phone on any app, and you'll find us, and you can listen to us and see the stories that we do every day. Thank you very much. This is the Smashy Business Show, part of the Smashy Business production, which is part of the larger Augustus Media Podcast Network. Take care. See you on Wednesday.
Thank you.